Oh, that's so disgusting. Oh my God, that's the worst thing I ever heard in my life.
TGIF, it's Manson Mitchell with Gary Manson, Suzanne Mitchell. A double shot of good conversation with great guests to jumpstart your weekend. Manson Mitchell, you're on the air.
Thank you, Eric Kramer. TGIF, everybody. This is Gary Mance.
I'm Suzanne Mitchell.
We are Manson Mitchell. We are in your ears now and hopefully throughout the hour. Glad to have you with us. And glad, of course, to be working once again with bad boy Benny Mathers at the board. Benny, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing very well. This is Sam, and he's filling in for Benny. Yeah.
We were talking Sam Elliott before he came on.
Oh, I thought it was Artie Johnson offering me a Walmetto.
There's that one, too. Well, you know, Gary, it's what's for dinner.
Yeah, that's right.
I'll work on it. That's all I had.
You have all hour.
I have all hour. Totally.
Good Sam Elliott, if you ask me. I thought it was pretty good.
Thank you, Suzanne, my one fan.
And before we go to our special guest today, I'd like to ask you, now we watch the Weather Channel and it's made the national news so that even here in Sarasota, we were seeing the footage of snow, particularly in Everett, they were showing, but I have a feeling it's pretty much throughout Puget Sound. Is that spate of snow over with?
Snowmageddon! It kind of came and gone. That's pretty much what I expected. We had like a couple flakes at the studio, but then literally like 10 miles north, they had like 4 feet. So I don't know. It's crazy.
Oh. So they're not throwing the buses onto the interstate this year?
Not yet.
Man, I remembered when that happened. Bus slid right down the hill.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the one that was overhanging.
Yeah, overhanging.
Oh, yeah, I remember that
one. Yeah, the interstate there.
Mm-hmm. And a couple of times, Suzanne and I, when we lived in the area and were driving to the radio station, what our listeners need to know is that 1150 AM KKNW is headquartered on the fifth floor of the T-Mobile building in Bellevue, in the Factoria area, and it's on a hill.
Yep.
And you may think you're going up, but you're going to find out otherwise in a matter of seconds on certain days. Benny, do you sometimes just sleep at the station?
I did actually on Sunday because I was a little nervous Sunday night to Monday morning. I was just a little apprehensive, a little nervous. I was out, you know, and I just like, you know what, I'm up. I'll just bebop it up to the station, and it was kind of coming down at the moment, and I figured it would just be a new wave of, you know, a couple feet, because of course snowmageddon and everyone can't drive in it. And around like 3 o'clock in the morning, then I took a little nap on the floor in here, and then I looked outside, it was all gone. I was like, what happened?
You know, Sam Elliott would have been impressed.
So, I think we've acquired a new character.
Yeah, right. I'm just trying to break it out. All right.
Today we're going to talk to somebody who has a very different accent, and he has a lot of expertise and some pointed views to share as we now
This is the third time.
We're in a historic passage in America. Yeah. An impeachment trial. Impeachment of President Donald J. Trump is underway, and we have a man with us who has some things to say about that and all things Trump and even about the status of the Republican Party in 21st century America. But first, why don't we go ahead and give the man his mad props.
The book we read by him came out in 2018, and we interviewed him twice, a week apart, part one and part two. But we just couldn't wait anymore. We wanted to talk to this gentleman some more. Patrick Andendahl has always had an interest in politics. And being multicultural, he views issues from a more international perspective. In 2004, 5 days before the election, he flew to Cleveland and pitched in to help with the political process. What he discovered was the dissolution of the American dream, which he writes about in his first book called Stupid Party. Ending up in New York via romance in the African bush, Andendahl Lau lives in Long Island with his wife, two children, and two dogs. His second book was Who is Jeb? Birth of the Stupid Party. And the book that I have in my hands is called Deliverance from Stupid Party Land, How to Eradicate the Destructive Forces Destroying American Democracy. And so for the third time, we are very pleased to have with us Patrick Andendahl. Glad you could join us today, Patrick.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show again. Yeah.
This is the year to talk politics. This is,
when isn't it? Unfortunately. Right.
Well, yeah, that's true. When isn't it? You know, we were looking through your book again this morning. We read a lot about Mike Pence. I know there's questions that Gary has. And one of the things that's kind of overarching, and I thought maybe it would be a place to start since we hadn't talked to you in a year, is on page 130, you write, do I have the right thing? Sanity still lives and thrives if you seek it out. Quite how this is occurring could be explained either by the laws of the universe demanding a balance or by technology running forward faster than myth can take us back. And so I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. And I wonder where you feel like we are today. If sanity is thriving, is it a matter of balancing good and ill? Or do you think it's a matter of technology just taking off faster than they can set us backwards?
Well, you know, you need, in these depressing times, one needs hope. One needs to be fine positive, even though you have to dig sometimes quite deep for them. And I guess when I was writing that chapter, I was looking at things that trends that are going well rather than all the many trends that are going badly. And, you know, some of the trends would be people becoming somewhat less religious. And therefore, if you do that, you're more inclined to go into critical thinking rather than mythical beliefs. I guess one of the things that I've been really, when you have dinner parties or whatever, you meet with your friends, I think the overwhelming sense is, like, people just don't want to talk about Trump anymore. You know, it's just, it's just so depressing. It's just so bad. It's so awful. And people are sort of burnt out. Not that we can afford to be burnt out, but that's sort of where we're at. Now, when it comes to positive trends, what I like to think about a lot is, for instance, transportation. I like to think of electric vehicles. I like to think of the possibility of the death of oil. I happen to believe, if you read all three of my books, and it's sort of... you know, Stupid Party in the first book, I sort of imply it began in 2000 with the 2000 election. But deep down, subconsciously, I knew that the roots of it were laid way before 2000. And it really, in my mind, when I really investigated it, and as I started writing the book about Jeb Bush, and it was really about the Bush family, it really, to me, became quite obvious that the trigger point was the assassination of Kennedy, which was to do with energy, I believe. And all the events since then, and Jimmy Carter's energy warning in 1977, where he said, you know, the America must get an intelligent energy policy, which is not that complicated to figure out what to do. Of course, he's ignored, and of course, we've now had all the Middle Eastern wars caused by oil interest or demand, terrorism triggered by those same events and all the rest. So what I like to do, and it's somewhat a controversial subject, and I think the penny has yet to drop with even 90% of progressive. What I like to do is talk about oil and how we can get rid of it. And obviously the man behind that, the man who's already put us 10 years ahead of the curve where we have been without him, would be Elon Musk and Tesla and what they're achieving, which will actually probably mean that a lot of car companies, you'll start figuring this out in two or three years, several legacy car companies will go out of business. Starting probably with BMW and then Daimler-Benz, and then it'll either be General Motors or Ford or Chrysler. So what's happening, this is really exciting. I mean, if you buy a Model 3 right now, you can get it for $39,000. Actually, technically, you can get it for $35,000. It's the same cost of ownership as a Toyota Camry, and yet which goes at, $23,000? So the five-year cost of ownership of those two cars are the same. And therefore, if you have a garage with the ability to have your own electrical source, why would you buy a Toyota Camry? It makes no economic sense. It makes no moral sense. It makes no ethical sense. So that's where we're at, and people are just beginning to figure that out. So that's what I find exciting. That's what I find... I mean, for instance, like the car industry spends $35 billion on advertising, I think, worldwide, $35 billion. And yet you just spend time looking at any one of those adverts and see what are they saying about their car. There's actually nothing of interest, of substance in what they're saying. They're selling to a part of your ego. They're selling. They're selling a dream. They're not selling a vehicle worth selling.
It's interesting, Patrick, that Gary and I had dinner last night with a couple who owns a Tesla. But now, to add to that, they are completely powering their home with solar. And they are powering it. They have so many solar panels that they sell the electricity back to the electric company, Florida Power and Light. And they run their car with all this excess electricity that they have coming back from Florida Power and Light. So it essentially costs them nothing to run their Tesla.
And that's correct.
I think to myself that these guys are brilliant.
Well, in New York, I pay 18, it's very simple, the math. I pay 18 cents per kilowatt. So it costs me 18, I have a 100 kilowatt car, so it costs me $18 in New York to fill a tank. With for 330 miles of range. So New York has some of the most expensive energy costs in the country. So I think the nationwide average is 13 cents. So it's $13 to fill a tank compared to whatever people pay for 300 miles, I don't know, $60. And then, of course, once you start getting your own energy, and I've got a rather cheap asphalt roof. I mean, Americans seem to think that a 30-year lifespan on a roof is acceptable, where I have a... In England, you know, we have Kentish tile, and that's 500 years. But 30 years, I mean, I'm thinking, are you nuts? And you can get you don't have to get solar panels anymore. You can get solar tiles that are just coming out, just becoming available, and they'll be guaranteed for as long as the life of the house. The energy part won't be guaranteed. I think the energy part will be guaranteed for, like, whatever it is, I think 30 years, I'm not sure. But, yeah, so you're getting to the point where if you can, and it's that very attractive roof, those solar tiles are now very attractive, and I think they're working. I'm not an expert on the math here, but I think in many cases they're working out to be the cost of ownership is there. If you know, once you build in a 5-7 year time frame, you're going to start making money compared to a relatively cheap roof. I mean, I'm not sure if it beats asphalt. I don't know, but
I think at one point in time it was very hard to get your money back from putting in solar panels from the expense.
Yeah,
but the cost of that has come down.
It's the Tesla. Right. It's the Tesla tiles that I'm interested in, and I got a feeling like the Mac is now version 3 has come out in the last 3 or 4 months, and I got a feeling that's way more affordable than their previous version, which when they came out with a big announcement 2 years ago. But they've been trying to like test it, and I think it's now about to hit big time, especially in places like California. And you know, if you've got California fire, you know, I think California is now making it all new construction has to have some sort of solar roof on top of it, I think. And I think the new building regulations are going to insist that you have the ability to have a power wall so you can charge your electric vehicle. And if you're looking at places like Australia and California are remarkably similar, where, you know, they've got these massive catastrophes going on left, right, and center. And these people who are experiencing this know they need to sort of get off the grid, have their own power supply, and all the rest. So I think that California and now Southern Australia, particularly because, you know, got that massive battery utility put there by Tesla, because he promised, and Australia is extremely corrupt because of energy interests and their coal interests, but he promised, that I think it was the governor or whatever they call of South Carolina, they were having an electrical grid blackouts and all the rest. He said, I can solve that problem in 100 days. And if I can't solve it in 100 days, I'll give it to you for free. So he did it. He did it in 100 days or less, and he solved the blackout problem they're having in South Australia. And now they're expanding that whole facility, and it's going to be a virtual grid of 50,000 homes. I think they're in now phase two of that process, where, you know, people can actually be off the grid and also putting money back into the grid, though, for excess power to prevent blackouts. So these battery plants that will replace these gas peaker plants is obviously working out really well. So it's another reason, you know, so that within all this stuff, we're running out of time on global warming, but we're also reaching a point of critical mass where we can get ourselves off oil demand and off ice engines. In 5 years' time, I think we'll be throwing rocks at people driving an ice SUV. I think the public's this opinion is going to move so rapidly. You've got countries like places in Rome now already immediately they're just banning certain streets around the Colosseum. They're banning diesel engines because of the car. I was actually in Italy and I just smelling the diesel and on the car because it just really made me mad. Really, I'm breathing in this NO2 diesel stuff from these corrupt German car companies. And it's not just Volkswagen. They're being encouraged by the German government to, they're not being prevented from by the German government from telling untruths about diesel and how clean it is. So they're still doing it, and they're now facing this existential crisis. I think Volkswagen may have just gotten the message. Their chairman, President Diess, is now saying, we've got to change before we go extinct like the Nokia phone. So they're figuring that out, and it's happening very rapidly. So that's good. That's exciting. And whatever projections you see for EVs coming out by and obviously Wall Street doesn't get it because these cars, they're analyzed by car companies. They're not analyzed by tech people. They're not understanding what's happening in the big picture. So Wall Street's still way off, with the possible exception of Kathy Woods at ARC and Ron Barron and one or two other people are beginning. The penny's beginning to drop. Is what's happening here. So that's exciting, and I enjoy thinking about things like that because I've been against oil all my life. And, you know, I'm sort of somewhat bitter and twisted about American oil energy. I always have been bitter and twisted about American energy policy.
Now, interesting that oil is made up of old dinosaurs, and the death of oil could be also the death of some of these old dinosaurs that
keep trying
to sell us oil. And we've been reading about flying cars in Europe now. And they're not going to need, you know, roads or infrastructure once that comes about.
Well, to be fair to Elon, one reason why I like Elon Musk so much is, you know, talking about flying cars. One of my great comments is like, he's not so keen on it because he says, who wants to be living in a world of flying cars? And I sort of get it. That's why his tunneling idea makes a bit more sense. But the thought of billions of cars up in the air is sort of, I guess they could follow routes. And it might be becoming somewhat feasible with battery technology. Battery technology does make, if you assume the sort of progress in the next 5 years, it would make short-haul flight possible. But I think it's mathematically impossible to have long-haul flights with batteries. I don't think that, unless there's some brand new invention. But, you know, so flying cars makes me a bit nervous. And it's, the fun thing about Elon Musk is, and I think people don't give him credit, he says, I want to live in a world where there's hope, where the world is better today than it was yesterday. And he's willing to consistently put his whole wealth on the line, like going to the casino, putting everything down on 36 and hoping to, and that's what he's done 3 or 4 times through his career, and it looks like it's paying off.
Patrick, I'd like to, one thing I will say about flying cars, we may someday get cars in the air, but you still won't get a lot of people to use their turn signals.
Well, of course they won't need to because it's all going to be autonomous. I think that, again, Musk is saying autonomy by the end of this year, which that's Musk time. So people who factor in Musk time think actually the chances of somewhere legalizing autonomous driving could be by the end of 2021. There's probably going to be some region in the United States that allows it. And once one or two regions allow it, then it'll just mushroom. It'll be explosive growth of autonomous driving. And also, I think the Waymo, the Google effort, the LiDAR, which they're experimenting with, Phoenix, they might be first to the plate with Phoenix, but it's geofenced, and I don't think LiDAR can work in the long term. And I think more and more people are figuring out that the Waymo approach is probably sort of a bit of a dead end.
When it comes to technology, particularly as it relies on computer technology and some artificial intelligence as well, Seattle and Puget Sound will be leading the way. So you are speaking to the people around whom these things are going to be happening in large measure. That's an exciting prospect. I wanted to get back to the political realities of our day, Patrick, because we have an impeachment trial in the Senate. They've been sworn in. They've taken the oath. We can go in any number of directions, Patrick, but let me just project ahead. It may be weeks. It may be 2 or 3 months before this is all over. But when it is done, and I see it as a foregone conclusion that President Trump will be acquitted by the Senate, What do we say to Donald Trump on the day the trial ends, he is acquitted, and he loudly pronounces that the radical Democrat hoax has been exposed, the witch hunt is over, total vindication in the Senate, and now let's go on to win in November of 2020 so that we can have four more years of Donald Trump? You're an astute political observer. How does that land on your ears?
That's a tough one. That's really tough. You know, it's not like facts really bother. It really matters that much anymore, it seems to me. And it's a, you know, it's a tough road to hoe, but we sort of know, we've known this is the likely outcome ever since this process was initiated. I thought Pelosi did the right thing in delaying it. She could have delayed it more. Who knows? I'm not going to second guess the chess game that's going on there in the Senate and in Washington, D.C. I think you sort of say, well, he's impeached. And it's not overwhelming argument, but he has been impeached by the Congress. And you say, look, depending on how the trial goes and depending on what John Roberts does, you know, the narrative will form around that. But in a scenario where they don't call witnesses, when there's more and more stuff that happened even since he was impeached, whether it be this guy Parnas or the General Accounting Office saying that they broke the law. I mean, nobody's ever complained about the General Accounting Office being a partisan organization ever. If you want an answer to any problem, either party, I was just talking to some right-wing person the other day who hadn't even heard of the General Accounting Office. If you want something, if you've got some idea with taxes or policy issues, you send it to the General Accounting Office, they shove it into this massive computer, and it spits out an answer. This is what happened. Well, the General Accounting Office, never heard either party really complain about them, has now said, you know, that withholding those funds is breaking the law. So the narrative rather depends on how what actually happens in the Senate. You know, you've got four or five Republicans who will you're worried about re-election, and they might try and do the right thing, in quotes, doing the right thing just purely on politics. Who knows? But, you know, you've got enough there that might just turn the tide and allow witnesses. And once you allow witnesses, you're not quite – you can't be sure what will happen. Obviously, Bolton and I've forgotten the other guy, the press secretary guy, the head of staff, Mulvaney, is it? You know, they were there. They witnessed it. They know it happened. Everybody knows, every Republican knows that he broke the law. But they're scared. They're scared now of the Justice Department run by Barr. You know, the way they take down their political opponents is they create a fake scandal and actually threaten people physically. It's scary. So you get people sending death threats to these guys. So it seems to me like the Justice Department is sort of out of control because you've got a really bad person running it. So, and hopefully the penny will drop. I think most Americans, I think I saw recently 70% of Americans would like witnesses, would like at least the effort of a fair trial here with everything, the facts coming out. So I think, you know, yeah, if it goes the way you said, I think there's plenty of things you can say. He was impeached. Everybody knows the facts of the case here, and anybody who wasn't allowed to speak, they would then cover it as a cover up. And remember, most scandals are really in the cover up, not the scandal itself. So I think it's quite easy to like paint any Republican politician with the shame of being part of somebody who's taking on and destroying the Constitution, which basically says you can't go after your political opponents using foreign aid.
You know, Patrick, I feel much the same way, and it's one of the things that confuses me more than anything else, is if you are a rational person, and Trump has already admitted, you know, to doing what it is he did, and you say to yourself, okay, well, I'm going to go with what my party wants. I'm not going to go against that. You know, what happens in time with these people? I mean, there's a part of me that wonders if it would be the destruction of the Republican Party to be going along with them.
It could be. And my feeling is, this time round, there must be consequences for people who broke the law. I think we got to this point in time of the president being able to get away with murder, almost, effectively. I think we got to this point in time because we keep, like, Joe, we must unify as a nation. So when in the past, when you had the second Iraq war, that was a war crime. There should have been consequences, right? If you looked at all the lies, then McCain choosing Palin as to be next in line for the president, somebody who was totally incompetent. There should have been consequences for that terrible, terrible, threatening decision, right? The lies told by Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan in that 2012 campaign, right, and the fact they were able to get away with it, there should be consequences. And now, so until there are consequences for telling lies politically, massive lies politically, or actually breaking the law, like being a war criminal, until there are consequences for that, what's stopping him for situations sliding worse and worse in the situation, and people behaving more and more badly? Obviously, there's a lot more going on behind the scenes on this Ukrainian affair than even we know today. The way that we understand today, the way they were undermining professional people in the acting public servants, and making stuff up in fake investigations and stuff like that to defame, libel people, just out of short-term political gain. There should be at some point there has to be consequences. People in the Trump administration, I know that some went to jail already, but it's nothing that it doesn't seem to be that serious. It's more like a wrist slapping in many cases. But senior people, including Trump, and especially when we get to it, we all know what the story is of the taxes, right? We know that he has. We all know what he's been doing with the taxes and when he has to hide it. It's obvious that he would give one set of numbers to the IRS, saying that property was worth far less than it was, and he'd give another set of numbers to the banks, saying his property was worth far more, in order to get the loans in the first place. And those loans were often backed by Deutsche Bank, which is also then getting funds, I believe, from the Russian government. But as this term comes out, serious jail time must be done. Otherwise, politicians will keep doing this. We've lowered the bar so far that nobody seems to give a damn when a politician lies.
Yes, it is true. In fact, I think Patrick, it's gotten to the point where for millions of people, if they subscribe to the right echo chamber, a lie, even though it's provable if you use objective standards and more than one source, for millions of people isn't even a lie, because there are, as we are reminded by such as Kellyanne Conway, there are alternative facts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're right, but I think, obviously, if you take the global warming issue, with people suffering, more and more people actually beginning to feel the effects themselves of it, I think that, the party that's been denialist, because they're in the pockets of special interests on this issue far more than the other party or the Republican Party, we must not forget, we must not forgive people who have denied what's happening with the climate, for instance, by way of example. And I think also, progressives need to approach some issues slightly differently, and they need to be far more straightforward. I think the issue of religion, Christianity, I never hear fake Christians tackled properly. You can't just call yourself a Christian and be a Trumpeteer. It's just not, they're polar opposite values. It doesn't make sense. Same thing with abortion. People who are pro-choice, I think they sort of tackle this wrong. They keep saying things like, you only care about the fetus, you don't care about the veterans, which is true, absolutely true. But what then, the point they're all missing, the point the progressives miss, is if you're pro-life and want to have that as part of the national agenda, policy agenda, you're actually increasing abortions by massive amounts. You're increasing maternity deaths by significant amounts. American maternity deaths is the only country on the planet. There might be some little squidgy little place somewhere in the middle of nowhere. But bar one country, I think it's the only country where maternity death rates are going up. Because if you can't talk about abortion, you cannot give women objective health care advice and resources and all the rest. So stop going around dodged the issue. Pro-life is fine in your own household, in your own home. As a value, it's fine. But to have it as a policy agenda, America's the only country, civilized or developed country in the world, that hasn't figured out how to handle abortion. And we need to start telling American pro-life people, you are guilty of a form of manslaughter on an epic scale.
Patrick Andendahl is our guest. He's written three books, maybe others, three that I know of. The one I'm holding in my hand is Deliverance from Stupid Party Land, How to Eradicate the Destructive Forces Destroying American Democracy. We'll be back with more of Patrick on the other side of a short break. Give us a couple of minutes. We are Manson Mitchell, and you are tuned in to Seattle's home of alternative talk, AM 1150.
The preceding audio was via a Skype call.
Staying connected with Gary Mance and Suzanne Mitchell is easy. Just go to mansonmitchell.com for the latest info on topics and guests. Friend Gary Mance and Suzanne Mitchell on their Facebook pages and like the Manson Mitchell Show page at facebook.com/mansonmitchell. If you're on Twitter, share a follow with Gary and Suzanne at Mance Mitchell. Join Gary and Suzanne Friday and Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. for an unusual show that covers everything from personal growth to the paranormal.
Here's an amazing act. Here's a tremendous act. Here's a startling act. The amazing, the thrilling, the greatest, spectacular, incredible, exciting, wonderful, world fame, most unusual novelty act.
The home of the A-Team of Alternative Talk is mansonmitchell.com. Heard right here on Alternative Talk 1150 AM or streaming live from your computer anywhere.
Hi, I'm Danica Patrick and proud aunt. Watching my nieces grow, play, and learn is amazing. But not every child gets to be carefree. One in six kids in the U.S. are hungry. One in six. That little girl sitting alone at the playground, she can't play like the other kids. She doesn't have the energy because she's hungry. School lunch will be her only meal today. It breaks my heart that this is the reality in our country, but it's something that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste. This food is then provided to families and children in need. Being a kid should be about using your imagination, learning, and having fun. These children shouldn't have to miss out on simply being a kid because they're hungry. To find out how you can help end childhood hunger in your community, visit feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
On Friday, Manson Mitchell welcomed Patrick Andendahl once again to discuss how to eradicate the destructive forces working against our democracy.
On Saturday, Pam Osley returns with what the color of your aura means, and yes, she will be taking calls.
Bringing you mastery and mystery since 2007.
We are Manson Mitchell, Friday and Saturday mornings at 10 on Alternative Talk AM 1150.
Talk radio with a purpose. Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back to Manson Mitchell, and thank you, Leslie Gore. It's my party, and I'll cry if I want to. We watch a lot of people on TV that are former Republicans and now are just disgusted with how that party is being handled. So we give them permission to cry. We are talking with Patrick Andendahl. And Patrick, I want to make sure that we get out the name of all three of your books and your website and how people can get those books.
Okay. Well, the first book, Stupid Party Massive Myth, is basically about it, you know, taking a timeline between 2000 and 2012-14 about how the Republican Party devolved and what it has become and continues to sink down that hole. I'd been in that book, I'd made some sort of minor error in being too kind with George Bush Sr. So the second book was really an attempt to address that issue of George Bush Sr., and that's such a complicated subject, it really can't be done. So I used Jeb as my proxy to talk about the Bush family and therefore the prehistory of how Stupid Party was born. That's from 1920s, I guess, through 2000. So that was what Jeb is really about, and the Bush family and the dynasty and the secrets they almost certainly hold to their grave. And then having done that, you know, I realized especially Stupid Party might be sort of getting a bit, you know, some of the data was sort of getting, some of it was getting a bit old, but the point still remained the same. So I decided to wrap up the trilogy by taking us through to 2025 and everything written in the third book should not get dated or old for another 7 or 8 years minimum, telling you, explaining more big picture reasons how mankind got to the position where you got such massive amounts of delusion and ignorance, especially within the Republican Party, but we're all guilty of delusion and ignorance to some extent. And so talking about that and then talking about a potential solution as to how this could rapidly unfold. I'm not sure if a solution can happen organically from the voter. I think the voter is getting so tired and beaten up. I got a feeling there has to be some sort of intervention in a few years' time. I mean, we could have good cycles within cycles, but the deterioration of American democracy is still highly, is likely to carry on even more insidiously with a less transparent person than with Pence or Trump. So that's what the deliverance is about. So I have a website called Stupid Body Land where I have various articles. I have a Twitter account, and you can always direct message me on that at Andendal. Twitter account.
Andendal. And I want to spell your last name for people. It's A-N-D-E-N-D-A-L-L. It's like three different words. And all.
Yeah.
And so I want to make sure people know how to spell it when they go to find you.
So you can always direct message me on Twitter, and I'll normally pick up on that at some point. I mean, I don't visit it every day, but and I guess you could. I think that's probably the easiest way to communicate with me if you've got something to say. But anyway, the books are all on sale on Amazon. The easiest way to handle it, and the three books will pop up there. And, the thing, I guess the thing I'm proudest about is the fact that I've been able to write this from a sort of almost a conservative perspective. I mean, by European standards, I'm relatively conservative. By American standards, I'm obviously not so much, because I think America, there is virtually no, I think virtually everybody is conservative in America. I think genuine left-wing people, even Bernie Sanders, by way of example, to me, isn't much more progressive than most of where Europe stands today. So, I don't regard him as anything he says as far-fetched at all. So there's really no far-left politics in the United States. it's all pretty tame stuff.
Patrick, you mentioned before the break, you talked about fake Christians or fake Christianity. I'll just go back in my mind to 1984 with Orwellian overtones. 1984, I remember tracking the presidential election that year, at the end of which Ronald Reagan had won a 49-state victory over Walter Mondale. During that campaign, and it really came to my attention the summer of that year, convention season, Ronald Reagan made an alliance, a pact, whether it was spoken or unspoken, there certainly were a lot of friendly words exchanged between himself and the moral majority led by Jerry Falwell. And I thought at the time, without subjecting it to any rigorous analysis such as might be expected from a guy like you, that this is not going to work well for our republic in the long run. I just remember having that gut feeling as Ronald Reagan got cozy with Jerry Falwell, this is not good for America going forward. From all that's happened since, do you think that's a reasonable conclusion?
Well, I think you were pretty prescient to even think that in 1984. I don't think many people would have been that concerned about it back then, but you take it now, the events of today, and Jerry Falwell's son or whatever being in bed with these guys, and you got to ask why. And, there's the whole, without being libelous, there's various theories as to how the pool boy and all that, the Florida pool boy and all that stuff going on. There's got to be something that's going on, because clearly there's not a single Christian value within Trump, right? I mean,
right.
And also, actually there's probably not really many Christian values in the Old Testament. So what I try and tell people is, if you're a Christian, by definition, you need to at least attempt to follow or believe in the teachings of Jesus Christ. That's very different. That's not an eye for an eye, by the way, and that's not stoning people. There's no and the values that they talk about in the Old Testament. I mean, that they keep mentioning. There's no. It's a pro-death value. I mean, human life didn't have any value in the Old Testament. There are 15 examples, 10 to 15 examples. Human life didn't have any value. The fetus didn't have any value until you're like 3 or 6 months old, and then they count. But they, the unborn, the children were constantly expendable. Nobody gave a damn in the Old Testament. So people who talk about the Old Testament, really, stop it. It's not a Christian book. The Christian book is the New Testament. And then you got to ask yourself, well, how come the Catholic Church, specifically, twisted the messages of Jesus Christ? Jesus Christ was not a misogynist, right? So how did that happen? So actually, I do write, all my books have sort of a religious theme about it. But what the way I've gone since writing these books is like, you know, you sort of give up looking for answers from the Bible, other than love and compassion from Jesus Christ. Obviously, those are important values, but seeking answers to the human experience, to everyday problems, other than compassion and basic Jesus' teachings, you've got to become more philosophical. So the great philosophers of this world, so going back 1,000 BC, 500 BC, they were explaining to us what we had to do, how we had to act. And if you actually, so I've been having a bit of fun with that in my own thought experiment game, saying, you know, what would Socrates say? What would Plato do? What would Confucius say? And it's really interesting when you look at their big ideas. Like Voltaire, he said, superstition, which is trumpeters, sets the whole world in flames. Philosophy, being critical thinkers, they quench them. So, you know, we're trying to deal with the nonsense spoken about energy policy, and we're trying to squench it with clean energy or whatever it is, you know. Whatever subject the trumpeters come up with, you know, we're just trying to solve the problem by understanding it. And they're just going on about it with their myths and their nonsense. One of the penalties, and again, Plato says, if you talk about, you know, the role of the young, because the young are really bad voters. So what Plato would have said, one of the penalties for refusing to participate in politics is you end up being governed by your inferiors. And I think that's sort of happening now. And I take, the idea of constructing a rational argument distinguishes philosophy, critical thinking, from the superstitious and religious explanation. Trumpeters tend to be religious, but can they be Christians? And obviously, I argue, no, they cannot be Christians, because the values are polar opposite. Another one, Aristotle. All men by nature desire to know. So if you rely on ignorance, that makes you a faulty human being, right? It's a character flaw. So again, all these people going back, Socrates concluded there is only one good, knowledge, and one evil, ignorance. Knowledge is inextricably bound to morality. Thus, we must continually examine our lives. So Socrates is basically saying, you know, the root of evil is ignorance. And if you think that's what the debate is, that's the debate we're trying to have in society. We're trying to educate people about basic facts, gun control, basic fact. I don't advocate, I don't go on about various gun control issues, but the message is the education people must have that owning gun ownership as a general rule does not make you safer. So you just need to become aware of the facts, and then you conduct your life accordingly, right? And I think, so if you go forget the Bible, especially the Old Testament, you're not going to get answers there. The answers are coming from the greatest thinkers this planet has ever come across, right? And they're basically saying the same thing: knowledge, decency, morality, compassion. Treat people the way you want to be treated yourself. You don't like separate families. You don't throw people out of the country. Immigration issues, the issue is really simple, and it's not explained properly to Americans. The U.S. Chamber of, if you're against immigration, the solution is dead simple. Just get the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to say you cannot get companies to stop hiring illegal immigrants. But they don't want to do that because they want the cheap labor. So, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is a Republican organization. So on the one hand, they want cheap labor. On the other hand, they want to blame immigrants for fake crimes and all the rest of the stuff. They want their cake and eat it. The immigration issue is purely, if it's a problem, it's purely an American Republican problem. and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce are the people who need to solve it if you want to end immigration. Of course, but then, of course, immigration, you don't want to end it from an economic point of view because they're vital. I think 50% of the founders of, or the sons of founders are from immigrants, right? Elon Musk is an immigrant. And you go to the Fortune 500 companies, the amount of diversity and dynamics they've brought to the economy is massive. So I'm not, you know, but if you are against immigration, don't blame the Democrats, blame the Republicans, because it's the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that's been setting the rules.
I like that.
You were speaking of philosophy and philosophers a moment ago, Patrick. One of the things that has always stuck with me, coming from Socrates, he was asked, what is the most vexing philosophical problem with which you have had to deal? And he thought for a moment and said, the prosperity of the wicked. And I thought, if you're talking about the problem of good and evil, how that gets diffused and deliberated in a society, it's like Suzanne likes to say, where you stand depends on where you sit.
Yep.
And so if you see wicked people getting ahead, that wickedness needs to be spelled out. It needs some definition. People who exploit a system for their own good and don't give a damn about how everyone else is doing can be lionized. They can, instead of there being penalties, they tend to get ahead. They get elected to high office. They become celebrities, while other people don't have more than $400 on hand if there's an emergency.
Yep. Well, again, the way the Republicans dodged that bullet, and they've been allowed to get away with it, is, well, they'll say, I just had a debate with somebody the other day, they say, well, I'm actually a libertarian, Ayn Rand. I don't believe in government. And it's funny, this guy was debating this in California, so, okay, you don't believe in water energy policy to conserve water for 7 years of drought, you know, like Joseph? Nope. But the thing about libertarianism is, like, it was born out of fascism. They say that they obviously argue that they're the opposite of fascism. But if you go back to 1950, suddenly fascism and being a Nazi was slightly out of favor because they were caught with their pants down. And so the Koch brothers and all the rest, so the way they got around that, because they obviously supported what the German industrialists were doing in the 1930s, because it's cheap labor or slave labor, which I think some massive percentage of the workforce were, like 40%. You know, it's good for the bottom line. So they liked that. So the way they got around that is to talk about libertarianism. Oh, I'm a libertarian. I don't want any interference. But the weakness of the argument, apart from the fact it's highly egotistical and really selfish, is a core principle, and Ayn Rand herself, you know, that's what she advocated. But the point is, what I would ask you to do is, like, okay, look at income discrepancy trends in the United States, and to a lesser extent even England, in the last 30 or 40 years, and just imagine if those trends carry on going the way they're going for the next 40 years. You only have one. There's only one mathematical outcome, and that might be initially a benign oligarchy dictatorship, but that will eventually obviously become unbenign. So that will lead to fascism. There's no mathematical way out of libertarianism stoked with continued income discrepancy trends. So, you know, right now you have the top 1%, the top 0.01%, the top 0.0001% running the country, running the economy. If you let that continue unabated, you will end up with fascism. And it will be malignant, and that will turn into malignant fascism. Isn't it? I just don't see a mathematical way out. So that's the problem, and that's how they're allowed to hide. Or I'm a libertarian.
I've known people who voted for the Republican candidate for about any office you care to name say to me, and they used to say it on air, I worked with some guys in radio who talked this way, I'm a small L libertarian. And I thought, and they were called out by someone else who was certainly a far lefty, don't tell me that you're a small L libertarian because you don't want to be labeled a Tea Partier or a member of the Freedom Caucus, as it's known nowadays. It's a way of avoiding social censure when actually your philosophy is not well thought out at all.
I mean, how do you deal with wildfire, the causes of wildfire, the causes of Africa becoming an uninhabitable continent, theoretically, and all the pressures that would put on Europe and the United States? How do you handle that what's the point of understanding the problem if you don't have the ability to execute on a solution, which is what lack of government regulation suggests? I mean, do you really want to drink bottled water when you know it hasn't been regulated? Do you want to breathe the air that some has been polluted because of profit? Do you really want that? Of course you don't. So people who say they don't want the government, no, the Republicans love to have bad government, then they can blame the government. And obviously the Democrats are always trying to figure out ways of having a better government. That's a major motivational tool for both parties. Of course the Republicans don't mind bad government. It's, what's the point of government? And if you think the people behind Trump's, the biggest person behind Trump's success financially is this guy who lives on Long Island, Robert Mercer. He bought Cambridge Analytica. He's the one who's totally anti-government. And he's still getting his wishes. And he's probably the main prime mover behind Breitbart and Cambridge Analytica and Trump.
Riddle me this, Patrick. If that is true, and I don't doubt you, if that is true, what is the connection, if any, between those sorts of enterprises and one of the master enterprises of the contemporary world, which is social media, notably Facebook? That sounds like a very dangerous and combustible.
When I wrote my Deliverance book, I was discussing Zuckerberg to some extent, and I was trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. You know, he was going on a tour, a listening tour, and he was probably thinking about politics just before he got into more problems with Congress. I'd always been concerned about him, but I was doing what I could to give him the benefit of the doubt. But really, I think he's gone off the rails, and I think evidently the younger generation is going off Facebook. It's us old fogies who still rely on it somewhat. But I don't use Facebook for personal reasons at all. But it's really scary how social media. And I think what is Facebook? I get confused now. They own Snapchat or something. I mean, or Instagram. I've forgotten who owns it. But you know, they're controlling. They have so much control about the news we get. And of course, social media is not about engaging the debate. Even I'm to some extent guilty of this, and I'm sure you guys are too. You're preaching to an audience that you want likes. And that's the problem with social media. You're not really focused on facts. You're trying to get likes. So you can't even, you know, many things I can't say even to a progressive audience because, you know, they're not hearing what they want to hear. And obviously progressives are more able to evolve and more able to change their views scientific proof that the conservative brain is more stagnant, not capable of evolving as rapidly as the liberal brain. So, but still, even on the conservative side, we're all guilty of it. You have your audience, and you sort of preach to that audience. And that's the problem with social media.
I've been trying to figure out, just in my own life, how I can use social media to best effect. And you're right. It is about the likes and the loves and getting people to share what you put out because that's cheap marketing.
And we're all guilty of it. We're all guilty of it. I mean, I don't know you guys well enough. I'm just talking in general. You know, you've got to be really careful. But you can. I think of radio. I mean, radio is guilty. Even American radio, the general rules, are terrible liabilities, not just social media. I've been on a lot of radio shows and just had to confront endless conspiracy theories. And it's like, really? Life is too short for this. And so I would say 80% of American radio is highly damaging. And we don't have that in the United Kingdom. And we have a tiny 2% of it. We don't have this nonsense that goes on. I just listen to podcasts. I can't find anything. I mean, NPR is boring. I don't want to hear about, you know, Peruvian folk dancing.
We're on the same page there, but NPR is hugely popular in the Seattle market. We have to go now, Patrick. I want to say thank you very much for joining us. We look forward to talking to you again. Patrick M. Andendahl. And the book I'm holding in my hand, I recommend to everyone, Deliverance from Stupid Party Land, How to Eradicate the Destructive Forces Destroying American Democracy. Thank you so much, Patrick. We'll do this again.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. Really appreciate it.
Very good. Coming up next is Christine Upchurch, followed by the Susan Harmon Experience, followed by American Road Trip Talk with host Gary Mance.
Today, the road to Roswell. Ooh-wee, look to the skies, everybody, and we hope you have a great weekend. Stay tuned to AM 1150.
The preceding audio was via a Skype call.